office, and I was here all the time. You thought I didn't make it, huh? Oh, I'll tell you. Sometimes, you know, life gets... Would you bring that clipping in here for me, Jerry, please, if you will? Do you know that certain Indians, certain Indian sects in India, have exactly 300,795,001 gods? 300 million gods. So naturally, you can have all kinds of problems. In fact, they have a god of the typewriter, for example. And any time you sit down, you may have to pray to the typewriter god that you will type good today. On the other hand, they have a god of simonize. For example, you're going to simonize. Have you ever simonized your car and had a hell of a rotten time with it? That's because you did not propitiate the simonize god before you started. Now, this is very true. Now, you see, I think one of the things about the Eastern religions often is that they recognize the reality of things, whereas we tend to be romantics and idealists. We tend to believe that if we buy the product that is advertised on television, it will be that way. Oh, no. Many a person has been profoundly disappointed. For example, have you noticed outright lies on television commercials lately? I mean, outright lies. I mean, stuff that you know simply isn't true. There is one commercial that is done for a credit card company. You see this? And they're all telling you should go to Europe this year. You know, they spend all your dough over there. You know, have you seen those commercials? And there's one of the characters says the following things. Yes, this is the... I really say... See, they're all supposed to be interviews with returning travelers. You've seen that kind? And curiously enough, you've noticed that some of these returning travelers are the same people you've seen on, say, for example, Easy Wipe commercials. They seem to... Yeah, you know. They're familiar faces. You say, what did I say? Oh, of course, I remember her. Yes, the White Tornado. Yes. One time she was attacked right in the kitchen. A damn White Tornado came right in and blew her sink right out. Well... I was watching one of these the other day, and this lady comes right on, right after, what was the irony of it all? She came right after the news, on television news, and of course the news is always bad. And so at that point, Walter Cronkite, or whoever the newsman was, he concluded his newscast with a look at today's market, as they usually do. And these mysterious numbers come up. There's some mysterious thing called Amex. And at that point, the newsman says, and today in the European money markets, the dollar continued to decline, and the Drobnik and the yen and the Kabuznik remained, as they have for the last 2 or 3 weeks, shaky and unfirm. However, the dollar now plunged to new lows, and the price of gold has gone up to the point now where gold is now supporting what appears to be the Western Hemisphere. And that's tonight's news. And on came the station break, and then a commercial came on. And right after that, see, the commercial comes on, and here are all these people returning from these places. Like one guy says, oh, Paris was fantastic. It's like it was 6 years ago. My God almighty, Paris was swinging. Oh, you can see the guy, he looks a little bit bombed out. You know, what the hell happened to him in Paris? And then there's a lady that says, well, we had a ball. I'll tell you, Europe was just the way it was years ago. It was wonderful, and it was so exciting. Everybody was so just delightful to us. And then on came a young girl who looked like a Hunter undergraduate. She had big black-rimmed glasses, you know, the intellectual type to let us know she knows what she's talking about. She said, yes, this is the perfect time to go to Europe because the dollar has never gone further than it's going now. You really get your money's worth now in Europe. I said, what the hell? What is this? An outright lie. Outright lies. I wonder, you know... If you say it fast enough, people buy it. However, there's another commercial where they do that same kind of thing. I wonder why ad agencies don't realize you reduce the credibility of the commercial by attempting to imply that the commercial is just ordinary people saying these things. You know, for example, there's one commercial that comes out where this lady says, she's got this kind of a nasal voice. She says, yes, I bought the Whoopi Mobile 8 because, well, it's just got the styling we like. My family, I have 17 kids, you know, and it's just a great car. And they're very, very helpful with me when I go there. They always give me exactly what I've asked for, and it's just the, it's just the kind of car I like.
Yes, you've been listening to Mrs. Herman Zlotnick, who was telling you why she likes the Whoopi Mobile 8.
That same lady I saw on the commercial not more than an hour before. What was she doing? She was hawking a magic cleanser with a magic ingredient that took tea stains out of the sink. Now, that lady, it's an odd coincidence that that lady always happens to be around where the camera is. And, of course, immediately the credence of the credibility of the commercial goes down the drain. Then there's another one, too, where this is an outfit that makes television. Apparently, I suspect that TV agencies, and I've done a lot of commercials, only are interested in other commercials. In other words, they judge the world by other commercials, not by what the world is doing. So there was one commercial here the other day that shows us, you've seen it. It's about a television company. And the announcer comes on, you hear the voice off screen say, yes, there's a rumor around that you have to go to European markets, to a European or a foreign country, to get workmanship that really is good these days. Yes, this is what people believe. But let's face it, the television set made in the Whoopi TV company is as good as any television set made anywhere in the world. Just ask typical American workers like this who make it. And you see these people looking. You've seen them? They come on one after the other. The only trouble is, I recognize all of them, and there's one girl in particular who apparently is masquerading when she isn't making television sets. She's masquerading as a stewardess on an airline that flies to one of the Caribbean islands. And she speaks with a strong, apparently, Jamaican accent. Now, I don't know. Maybe she's moonlighting. But the point is that that you reduce the credibility of what you're saying by going out and getting some actor that everybody's seen. And you say, he's a typical American worker like this man. You've seen that. Well, you haven't. Well, you have a good TV set. You have a set that rejects a lot of that bad stuff, right? You do. How do you work on a filter like that? A glop filter? I see. You have a TV set that has got a built-in editorial filter? Wouldn't it be unbelievable wouldn't it be great if science could really do what science claims it can do? You know, science has often said it could solve all of man's problems. You've heard it, you know, if given a free hand. Well, writers say that too about themselves. I've known many a writer who playwrights feel that. Everybody feels that. Newscasters, everybody feels that if given a free hand, he could straighten up the world. But you've heard it over and over again that science can do it. You've heard this slogan, haven't you? Better living through chemistry. I guess that did not apply to the pollution of Jamaica Bay, did it? Although those are chemicals in Jamaica Bay, aren't they, Herb? Is that what they refer to when they mean pollution? They don't mean the fish, do they? Well, I don't know. I mean, pollution, the fish pollute, you know, too. They too have natural functions, you understand? Of course, you know, that's natural. But I don't want to get into this. This gets very, very complicated. We're getting into deep religious waters here as to what constitutes pollution and so forth. That's a religion today. But there is this belief that science could, and if it were given the unlimited opportunity, it could solve man's problems. Science fiction is based on this, primarily. You've noticed that that those other societies, wherever the guy goes in a Ray Bradbury story, they have solved all the problems. They really have. They don't have cancer. They don't have war. And the implication, of course, there's twofold. The implication, one, that they are morally superior, of course. The other is that their technology has been devoted only to good works. They never made an atom bomb. They made giant machines that remove cancer from radishes. You know that you've read that stuff, haven't you? Well, now, wouldn't it be fantastic if we began to define evil to man in ways other than we usually define it? Most people think of evil always as primarily war. Love, it's a lack of love. This is our current definition of evil. Evil means you don't love people. But wouldn't it be interesting if we began to redefine evil? And we got a giant team of evil definers who sat and watched, say, 175 hours of your average network television. And we got the scientists to work on an evil detector, a glop detector. And they could build it into a television set. And this automatic, you know, of course, that in all tuned circuits, you can build what we call a noise blanker or a noise rejector. Correct, Herb? That is correct. Now, I've even worked on a few of these and built a few myself. A noise blanker or a noise rejector is a device. It's a circuit within an electronic circuit, within a circuit, actually, that rejects, theoretically, most unwanted noise. Now, what is noise? Well, the sound that a neon sign makes, you know, that comes out every time the guy down the bar turns his thing on down there. It'll reject that, theoretically, and it will, pretty good. It rejects ignition noise. You may not know it, but the ignition noise is a great roar over this city. you don't see it. That's an interesting kind of pollution nobody talks about. Everybody talks about the pollution that comes from the exhaust blowing out noxious gases. But you should see, you can watch it on a scope. You should see the electronic pollution of a city like New York when all the bad equipment in the whole city is turned down at once. I mean, I'm talking about radios that are oscillating all over the place. I'm talking about bad stereos that oscillate. Yeah, they produce signals. I'm talking about all kinds of equipment, not just a diathermy equipment, that produces a roaring signal, electronic signal, which figuratively and actually blanks out any benign signals that may be trying to get through. You realize that there are signals that are legitimate. And so if you watch a scope, now this is probably something none of you have ever thought about. If you have a friend who is hip to electronics, really, I don't mean a guy that once built a Heath kit. I'm talking about somebody who knows what he's talking about. He could tell you that over the wide spectrum of broadcast frequencies that can be conceivably used by electronic media of one kind or another, over the wide spectrum, there is a fantastic amount of pollution created just by the city. And you can actually graph it. When everybody's asleep, of course, obviously, their stereos are not on, their bad TV sets that oscillate all over the place aren't on. And by the way, television sets produce a hell of a signal, many of them. Oh, wow, particularly color TV sets. Whew! You don't probably are aware of this. You think that the amateur down the street is interfering with you. Well, as a matter of fact, 99 times out of 100, it's the guy with the cheapo television set upstairs that's interfering with you. Do you agree, Herb? TV sets and all this cheap stuff that people have been buying by the hundreds of millions for the past 10 or 15 years have produced an almost impenetrable pollution of the, for want of a better name, what used to be called in early electronic radio texts, the ether. That's a great phrase, the ether. And so you can see it actually growing. If you have a scope and you have a broad-tuned system where you can tune from the very low frequencies, what we call long wave, up around 200 meters, up around, you know, way up at the top of the dial. If you were to take your radio dial, you know where it ends at 55 on the AM dial, if you could tune it all the way up to, say, 50, if you could tune it, say, to 300 up there, if your dial was extended, that would be long wave. Correct, Herb? So when you get up there, you find this great roar, fantastic roar. And it goes down all the way through the broadcast band, down through the VHF bands, down through shortwave, what we call shortwave, all the way down until it gets absolutely fantastic down around the UHF bands, which are down in the vicinity of 140 megs and below. You get this great roar, and it starts out about, oh, maybe you can see it beginning about 6 o'clock in the morning as the first trucks start getting out on the street. How does ignition sound? It's fascinating. You can listen to it, and you can actually hear a guy approaching for maybe two or three blocks when it's quiet in the morning. You can hear this, that pop. It sounds a little like it, doesn't it? Everybody goes. Then you hear guys with V8 engines. You hear this. That's another kind. Then you hear a guy with a two-cycle engine going by, some guy with a motorcycle, you know, and it goes. Oh, do they make the noise? And all the way, usually, and this is an ironical fact, usually the smaller the device, the more interference it causes, a strange contradiction. In other words, a motorcycle will often cause a lot more pollution, electronic pollution, than, let's say, a Fifth Avenue bus going along, because of the nature of the signal that it puts out. And so you can hear this great roar, and if you were to watch it on a scope, you could probably see it. You could. I've seen it actually happen. You see it slowly growing. The baseline is nice and clean at first. It's 6, let's say it's 5:30 in the morning, and it's a nice, clean baseline. That nice, clean, green line, thin line across the scope. And then all of a sudden you start seeing things, little grass growing, and it looks just like grass. Until you see this grass growing higher and higher and higher, and then it hits a fantastic peak right in the middle of the day when everything's going, and all the hospitals got their diathermy and shortwave, they've got their radioactive materials going, and they've got their x-rays going, and the neon signs are going, the bars are going, and the guys have got their stereo going, and the television sets start coming on, and all the while this is growing until finally it reaches a point roughly about 5 o'clock is the absolute peak. It reaches a point about 5 o'clock when almost any really legitimate signal has about as much hope of making it through as, let's say, your average striped bass has of having a good afternoon in Jamaica Bay. And most people are totally unaware of this. One day that's going to be a big issue. Do you agree, Herb? It will ultimately be a big issue. And people are going to become aware of this, and there's going to be hell to pay. By the way, I might also add that this is not just a U.S. problem. It is a world problem, like all pollution is. It's a world problem. And today, if you tune across the shortwave bands, you hear all kinds of strange pollution signals all over the bands. They call them intruders. You know, they have now, I don't know, is this boring you at all? Well, see, a lot of people are not interested in technical. They're really not. But they have even now, today, in many countries, what they call an intruder watch. You know what an intruder watch is? This is a group of people, technically competent people, who literally patrol the bands. It's almost like a vigilante committee. They patrol the bands for illegal signals that can be produced by foreign governments, all kinds of things. And they keep a log on various signals that are not legal in various parts of the spectrum, which is just like a cop patrols the New Jersey Turnpike for illegal cars that go past without a license or driving the wrong way on a street. Hey, listen, not to change the subject, but in a way it is the same subject. You hear people talking all the time about the great change that's come about in the media in the past 100 years, something like that. And there has. It's been a fantastic change of all kinds. But, I suspect that some of the changes are not only in the amount, but also in quality. This is a fascinating concept. The other day, in fact, I'll have to concede it has been more than the other day. A few years ago, maybe some of you got copies of it. A few years ago, I worked for a couple of years to produce an anthology of a famous newspaper writer of around the turn of the century. The book came out, and it was published by Putnam. It was called The America of George Ade. Did you ever see a copy of it, Herb? You haven't? Well, I've never seen an engineer here at the station ever read one of my books. Well, let's be honest. I've never seen an engineer read. They get all excited over Lafayette catalogs and TV guides, but actually reading is hard for many of them. And nothing to do with ignorance. It's it's another thing. But this I learned something doing this, because I had the chance at that time to go over by microfilm, and the records are there, by microfilm, I went over newspapers that were published between roughly 1895 and about 1915 was the time that I was reading through microfilm. Have you ever used the microfilm section of the library? That's fascinating. And you'd be surprised what they've got. And so you can actually read a paper that's been out of print and has not even been published at all for maybe 40 years, and they have copies of them. And so I was reading these things, and the first thing that hit me, I began to have a suspicion of this. reading this stuff, I couldn't believe the kind of writing that was in the newspapers at that time. I'm talking about really fascinating writing. Well, then, more recently, I've had the occasion to read a whole cross-section. I haven't even told you about it, Jerry, but I've read a whole cross-section, again through microfilm, of writers who were writing in American newspapers from about the time of World War I up to about 1932, that period. And I've been reading specific kinds of writers. And I think one of the great changes that has come in American life most dramatically, I mean, judging from looking at those papers to now, is the changing role of the critic in American life. It's fascinating. Now, I'm talking about all kinds of critics. I'm talking about a guy that writes a column of political criticism. I'm talking about a guy that writes literary criticism, dramatic criticism, all kinds of criticism. And the great change that's come about is that critics today have become the most humorless of men. I mean, really humorless men compared to the critics of comparatively recent American past. And I, for one, as a performer, I'm talking about as a performer, let's take my radio performing or my work maybe on the stage at Carnegie Hall or, say, in the pages of Playboy or a novel I've written. Let's say my current collection, like Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories. I would much rather have been reviewed by a critic of a period where they had style and humor than today. For example, I would much rather be reviewed by, say, Robert Benchley, who, by the way, was a famous critic. How many people knew that he was a really famous writing critic? They always thought of him as a guy that did these shorts, but Benchley was a famous critic. I would much rather have been reviewed by Benchley than, say, Bob Williams of the Post. Bob Williams of the Post writes with all the verve and humor of your average bank teller who belongs to several do-gooding organizations. This is his, and it's kind of sad, you know, to see, and I'm not putting him down, but I'm telling you, this is all the way through. If you read radio and television critics in the Post or in the news, particularly in the Times, they're sober-sighted reporters who think the only thing worthy is an involved show that is about the drug problem among the youth, which is certainly fine. But the humor, no. it's a very lost art. Now, humor, I suspect, is comes from not taking yourself that seriously. In fact, I know it comes from that. And so you take a guy like, say, Alexander Wolcott, writing a play review. These are the guys that I've been reading recently for this project that I'm involved. That's not to say they weren't serious about reviewing, nor reviewing what they did, but the humor with which they wrote came out of the fact that they obviously got a great zest in life, a great zest in living. Even when they went to see a bad play, it was a gas just to go see it, you know, and they wrote about it. Another guy that wrote with great humor in the political world was Mencken. We have nobody parallels that today. It's just nobody. A few feeble attempts by guys like Baker. They're just Russell Baker. It's just kind of. I always have a feeling that he's writing humor for the PTA, and they love it at the PTA. Sure, it's always about the kids come in and all this. You know, it's Alan King type humor, which leaves me about as cold as last week's turnips. I'm not putting it down, but this is not the sardonic gimlet eye of a Mencken. And Buchwald is not in it with him. I mean, but he writes, he's funny, yes, but it's the thought, it's the, I don't know what it is, it's kind of a, I suppose you might say, a razor eye. So I think this has been a great change. And anybody who uses a medium, say, for just pure pleasure and joy of using it, is definitely going to turn off a guy like Williams. You've got to have a message, and your message has to be very obvious. You've got to wind up with a speech. you have to wind up with a speech on how we should all go straight, be more like me, think more like me, think more like the good folk, of which, of course, I'm a representative. And, what, you having problems with time? No, I didn't think so. That's it. Bring it on, Big Herb. There's never any problem. I just thought, you know, because people write to me occasionally and say, what do you think of critics and so on? I said, fine. I have nothing against critics. Except that I find today a man thinks of himself when he becomes a critic, apparently. It takes a certain ego, first of all, to believe that you can judge for all of mankind somebody else's work. Now, that right there says that you take yourself damn seriously. And another thing I think that most critics have going for them today is they're into fashion. It's very fashionable today to be a preacher. This is the age of the preacher. Now, I say a good critic should differentiate between preaching. In other words, if everything is some kind of a track today, there must be good tracks and bad tracks. There must be well-written tracks and badly written tracks. In other words, good thoughts are not enough. Good intentions are not enough. You know, you can look down through the critics and find what they approve of. And they almost always approve of something that is quite boring when you actually watch it, but it has a nice thought. It has a nice thought behind it. And so I suspect that this is one of